This is the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast brought to you by Art Wiederman, CPA with Ide Bailey. Whether it's taxes and investing or planning wisely, Art is the expert to make your dental practice profitable. At Ide Bailey, what inspires you inspires us. We provide a suite of accounting and advisory services dedicated to the total care of your practice. Visit our website to access our tools and resources tailored for dentists, idebailey.com/dentist. That's idebailey.com/dentist. This podcast is distributed with the understanding that Art Wiederman, CPA, and Ide Bailey, LLP are not rendering legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Listeners should consult with their business advisors before acting on any of the information or opinions shared. If you have questions and or feedback, make sure to email Art over at awiederman@idebailey.com. That's A-W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N at E-I-D-E-B-A-I-L-L-Y.com. You can also give Art a call at 657-279-3243. Without further delay, here's your host, Dental CPA Art Wiederman.
And hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast. I am your host, Art Wiederman, CPA. Welcome to the podcast as we close out 2025, if you can believe it. We have been doing this podcast now for over 7 years. We're pushing 250 episodes. We've got thousands of listeners all over the country, and I'm very proud of the work that we've done and my team at Ide Bailey. I'm a dental division director at Ide Bailey. And today I have one of my very, very good friends in the dental world on the podcast with us. And, you know, when you hire an attorney to work with you in any kind of a business, I have always thought it is so important to have a specialist. And my guest today is Sean Dumm, who is a dental specific attorney. And for those of you who don't know, that there are dental-specific attorneys. We're dental-specific CPAs. Every day, Sean is either working with a client on buying a practice or selling a practice or negotiating their office lease terms or reviewing the office lease or helping a doctor with associate agreements, partnership buy-ins and buyouts. And Sean is doing this every day. So he is seeing everything that you can see. And we're going to kind of give you some of the rules of the road. We're going to talk to you about what you should be doing with an associate. You know, if you're an associate listening and a senior doctor comes to you and says, hey, I want you to sign this agreement. We're going to talk about, well, what should you sign and what should you not sign? If you're a senior doctor, same thing. What should be in that agreement? We're going to talk about office leases today. You know, I mean, that's one of the biggest investments doctors you're going to make. So Sean is my my go-to guy, and I send him many, many clients, and his clients are very happy with him. And so we'll get to Sean in a moment. I want to thank my wonderful partner in crime, Lorraine Kent and Belmont Publishing, Decisions in Dentistry Magazine. It's www.decisionsindentistry.com. They have 140 continuing education courses at a very reasonable price. Go to www.decisionsindentistry.com. If any of you are going to be in Chicago in the third week of February. Now, it is cold in Chicago, which is why they call the Chicago Midwinter Conference the Chicago Midwinter Conference. I will be speaking in Chicago. I do have a heavy ski jacket and sweaters and layers, so I will be ready. If you're going to the Chicago Midwinter, come by my lectures on financial planning and metrics and numbers and say hi and tell me that you're a podcast listener. That would be wonderful. If you're also planning on going to the National Academy of General Dentistry meeting in Las Vegas in June, I will be doing a full day there. Look forward to that. Again, I want to just also let you know, since we're at the end of the year, if you haven't gotten a lot of guidance from your CPA You haven't gotten a call to say, let's sit down and figure out how we can take advantage of the one big beautiful bill and setting up retirement plans and the new bonus depreciation rules and buying equipment and putting your family members on and all that stuff. Give us a call at Eide Bailly. My email is awiederman@eidebailly.com. That's A-W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N at E-I-D-E-B-A-I-L-L-Y.com. Or call me at 657-279-3243.
Be sure to check out our new Eide Bailly podcast, Ebb and Flow, a business podcast providing inspired insight on issues and trends the middle market faces. Hear unique business stories, get answers to frequently asked and unasked questions, and understand business topics that matter to you. Available now on your favorite podcast platform.
All right, with that, let me get to my guest. I have known Sean Dumm for probably 20 years. Sean is a dental-specific attorney in San Clemente, California. He not only lives and breathes dental as a dental attorney, but he is also married to his wonderful wife, Karen, who I've also known for a long time, and who is also one of the, as far as I'm concerned, one of the best endodontists in the country. And I have personal experience of her doing work on myself and two of the other Wiederman family members. So everything that Sean and Karen talk about other than kids is dental. Is that not right, Sean?
That's pretty much how it goes these days. Yes. Thanks for having me on, Art.
Well, welcome to the Art of Dental Financial Management. Now, Sean and I, I not only do I consider him a professional colleague and do refer him a lot of business, I also consider him a friend. And we do talk football. And I unfortunately have to bring up now the last time that we recorded was in the winter of 2020, right around pandemic time, and that was right after you had gone to the Super Bowl and watched your beloved Kansas City Chiefs with Mr. Mahomes and Mr. Kelce and all those guys win the Super Bowl. Unfortunately, and I will be very gentle, Sean, your team was unfortunately eliminated from the playoffs this week, and your quarterback, was it a torn ACL or NCL, or what did he tear?
I believe it was an ACL and an LCL.
All right, so we will be very nice to you today.
Thanks. Hey, you know, the bottom line on that is that when we did this podcast last year, or the last time you had me on this podcast, it was in late February or somewhere around there. It was a couple weeks after the Super Bowl. I was coming off a high of watching my team win the Super Bowl for the first time in my entire life. And since then, it's been an absolute miracle run of, you know, we got the world's most famous pop stars on the sideline and just all the wins. And, you know, you got to pay the piper after a while. And they had a magical run. And, you know, you can't be sad that it's over. You got to smile that it happened, you know, and who knows, you know, like look at Tom Brady. He had a big start to his career, 3 Super Bowls, had a ACL tear and Achilles. And then after that, came back and won 4 more Super Bowls. So you never know what's in the future.
Well, we've just changed the podcast to The Art of Dental Football. So there we go. Yes. I like that.
The art of football. Exactly.
There you go. That's all that really matters, of course. There you go. Well, anyway, Sean, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about your professional journey, where you've come from, and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. Let's see. So my name's Sean Dumm. The last name's horrible, but it's spelled D-U-M-N, so at least it's not as bad as it could be. As Art mentioned, I practice in representation of healthcare providers, primarily dentists, and I have been doing that for quite some time now. I've been out of law school now for 25 years, so I'm getting old. It'd be 25 years this year, but I've been practicing with an emphasis on working with dentists for a little over a decade now. Just kind of fell into it when I met my wife, who was in residency at the time. And, my father-in-law was a dental broker and my mother-in-law was a hygienist. And so I kind of fell into the world of dentistry. And so I came to kind of develop an appreciation for the business needs and learning about the aspects of the profession of dentistry, but also the legal needs of dentists. And it's flourished since then. I get a lot of job satisfaction from helping young dentists get into a fixed situation instead of picking up a day here, a day there, and also on the flip side of things, a lot of satisfaction in helping older doctors that maybe just don't quite have the passion for it anymore, or maybe it's becoming physically taxing to sit in that chair with their head kind of in a bad ergonomic position every day, and helping them get across the finish line, to a retirement or whatever comes next. And so, like I said, it's been very satisfying to do this work.
Well, again, you do a really good job, and let's teach our listeners some stuff that hopefully they can use in their situation. Let's start off by talking about associate agreements, Sean.
Okay.
So let's look at the young dentist associate who's going to start a job. Maybe it's their first job. Maybe it's not. Why is it important for a young dentist to have a written agreement to work for another dentist in a dental office?
Great question. So a handshake deal, creates a lot of uncertainty, right? And so the benefit of having a written associate agreement is it's going to first and foremost promote the expectations of both the associate and the practice, right? One of the major goals would be to clearly define our compensation terms, as well as to establish a formula for how we might determine what that compensation would be. From the seller's perspective, of course, there's a desire to protect whatever proprietary interest they can, which is going to vary state to state. And I'm sure you'll probably ask me about that in a bit. And then also, if there's a plan for a transition to an associate buy-in or ownership, to maybe establish what those timelines might be and the conditions under which the associateship could be terminated or extended or transitioned into a partnership or ownership situation.
Now, what about on the standpoint of a seller? A seller is going to say, well, wait a minute. If you tie me down to an associate agreement, I'm going to have to be under some rules. But are there advantages if you're representing a senior doctor whose practice has grown enough to bring in an associate? Talk about on the seller side, why is it important?
Well, again, some of the same general goals to promote the expectations of the practice, right? From the seller perspective, it would be to protect whatever proprietary interest you could with respect to trade secret, non-competition agreement, if permitted in your jurisdiction, as well as, clearly define the compensation terms so we don't have the ambiguity and dispute that can be created by just saying something as simple as, I'm going to pay you X percentage of production or collections, and not really defining what that exactly means.
Right. So let's get into some of the meat of what should be in an associate agreement, Sean. So mm-hmm. a dentist comes to you and says, hey, I need an associate agreement drafted. Mm-hmm. Talk about some of the provisions that should be in that associate agreement. Get into some of that.
Sure. An associate agreement will have a lot of components to it, but the material meaning, a legal word for meaning, important, most important things that you might have in an associate agreement, first of all, would be, what is the length of the agreement or the term of the agreement? How can the agreement term be renewed? If the office has multiple locations where they will be primarily assigned to work, what is the status of the agreement? Is it an employment agreement or is it an independent contractor agreement? Because those have very different implications on almost every aspect of the contract. Does the associate need to supply materials or equipment, or are they being supplied by the company for which they work? What are the terms of compensation? That's going to be probably first and foremost for a lot of our young associates. What expenses are covered by the company versus the obligations of the associate? Are there any benefits if it's an employee relationship? And then how do we deal with aspects of repairs or retreatments if necessary? Whose obligations to pay for insurance, and also possibly addressing indemnification language in the event of any liabilities that might come up. And then finally, as I mentioned before, for the employer or hiring party, it would be the non-compete language and trade secret protection language.
Yeah, we're going to get into non-compete here in a second. But, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things I want to talk about is the compensation part. Mm-hmm. And, something, Sean, for the associates out there is, I think they should be, you know, the associate dentists who are looking to work in a senior doctor's office, you know, they're going to get paid based on collectible production. So, we know that certainly less than 10% of the dental offices in America are fee for service. If it's fee for service, then the fee schedule is the fee schedule. But if the doctors have either PPO or even worse, HMO plans, then how, I think it's important that the associate doctors ask questions. You know, in other words, if a crown in a fee-for-service office is $1,500, but a crown in the office that the associate is looking to go to is $700, that associate's going to make a lot less money and is going to work a lot harder. Do you get into any of that conversation?
Well, you know, usually by the time the person gets to me, they've already identified who it is that they have an offer for.
Right.
And so that they'll already be informed on what kind of practice it is. Right. And so normally when unless somebody would come to me and say, I'm in discussions with this doctor. He's never had an associate before. He wants to bring me on. It might be a little bit more ambiguous about the hiring party and what they want to do in terms of compensation, but you could see a lot of different structures. You could see an hourly wage. You could see a per diem wage that, you know, is just one fee per day for working the shifts. You could see percentages of collections, percentages of production, or some sort of hybrid of a base wage with some sort of bonus structure based upon a hybrid production or collections, or even other bonus structures. So, there's a lot of different ways it could be structured, you know, and some of that could be informed, like you said, by what kind of practice it is, you know.
Right. Do you ever see a mathematical example in the contract that says, okay, here's an example? Because I know you and I have both seen, mathematical examples and formulas that, someone from MIT with a math degree wouldn't understand. Mm-hmm. So do you ever see mathematical examples in an associate agreement for a doctor?
Yeah, certainly. You wouldn't generally want to hire me to do math. That would be maybe more your territory. But I do tend to do it. Yeah. So normally, you know, when I put the compensation formula in there, I personally like to have a couple examples of what that might look like. So, and the examples would be in the agreement to illustrate, for example, how adjusted production or adjusted collections, as it's being defined, is compensated, or an example of the total amount of per diem days exceeded what the percentage would be, or the percentage exceeded what the per diem would be, just to see how it's kind of applied and calculated. I know I'm not alone in that, in terms of like trying to put some production examples or compensation examples in the contract just for illustrative purposes. And again, as I circle back to what I said initially, the goal is to promote the expectations of the parties, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you had mentioned covenants not to compete. And that's a big deal. I know that senior doctors want to enforce them. You and I both know that in California, covenants not to compete are generally, unless something has changed that I don't know about, are generally not enforceable, unless we're talking about a sale of a practice. But in many other states, they are. So talk about a covenant not to compete. And again, we have a lot of listeners in California. If we can't do a covenant, are there some other things we can do in the agreement?
Right. So understanding that this podcast goes out, you know, everywhere in our audience, maybe from all different jurisdictions. You know, while I am working in California and primarily representing California clients at this point, I am licensed in a couple other states. I used to live in the Midwest in Kansas City. So I've got, you know, licenses out there. And I am aware that other states do not have the prohibitions on non-competes like we do in California. Just to touch base on California for the California listeners, California has a public policy, you know, that says that any type of contract that restrains a person's ability to engage in a livelihood would then be void as a matter of public policy. That is a California prohibition. Other states, it's going to be state to state. You're going to have to check your jurisdictions locally to see what's permitted in terms of non-competes. Some states will not allow them. Some will. Some will have case law that will define what those radiuses or time periods are in terms of reasonableness. I can tell you that in 2024, in April, the Federal Trade Commission had issued a rule, just a administrative ruling banning most non-competes, but it was immediately challenged in court in Texas. And my understanding was the Texas court blocked the rule implementation that would ban non-competes, saying that it was arbitrary. And then the Federal Trade Commission vacated its rule and dropped the appeal in the courts, such that that is no longer being sought to be applied as a blanket nationwide. So now we're kind of, specific case-by-case enforcement at that level. So there is no nationwide ban, although there almost was there for a short period of time. So it's back to whatever your state laws would be. And so that's why it's so important to, you know, communicate with an employment law attorney in whatever jurisdiction you're in to evaluate what's being asked of you in the contract and whether that's permitted under the laws of your state.
And if a covenant not to compete is not permitted like it is in California. Mm-hmm. Aren't there some other provisions you can put in an associate contract, some other covenants to, I'm not going to say get around it, but I guess I'm going to say get around it.
Certainly. And again, this will be state to state in terms of what you can get away with. Again, in California, the big thing that you're trying to protect is the trade secrets. And so you would spend a lot of time defining what your trade secrets are, which may include, for example, patient records, aggregate information of like client lists, customer lists, recall schedules, things like that, and prohibit the use of those trade secret and confidential and proprietary information in to be used against you in competition, right? So you can still protect yourself under unfair competition laws of your states, trade secret laws, and try to enforce your rights under what might be a violation of an unfair business practices act in your particular state. Another thing that you could do potentially, depending on the state you're in, is have, you know, non-solicitation provisions in the agreement as well. Some states, if you're an employment relationship, you might be able to restrict the person's ability to work for other people concurrently to you, if you're an independent contractor, the very nature of independent contracting is the ability to, you know, contract with a multitude of people. So that may not be on the table. So it just kind of is going to be, again, a state-specific analysis as to what's permitted under the laws of your particular jurisdiction. And so that's why it's important to have some consult with an employment law attorney that's familiar with your state.
Yeah. And so I'm going to throw you a loaded question here, and then we're going to move on to office leases.
Okay.
What about senior doctor who says to junior doctor, hey, you know what? My buddy just down the street, he's a dentist. He just hired an associate. Let's just copy his associate agreement and we'll just change the names and it's probably good. Or there's this thing called LegalZoom out there. Mm-hmm. Why don't we just get this off here and we'll just save the fees of the attorney? Talk about, and I'm being facetious, you know that, Sean. Talk about the dangers of not working not only with an attorney, but with a dental specific attorney who does this every day.
And certainly. The other thing that you didn't mention is that people will now go to large language model AI platforms like ChatGPT and try to, you know, Google up a contract, right? And you'll have the issues of, well, one thing that I think is common with those types of contracts is that they may not even be implementing the laws of the state or maybe, you know, just on their face, not enforceable. So I can say, like in a state like California, where you have very, very specific bans, you could put all the language you want in there about how, like, if something isn't enforceable, the courts will modify it and, you know, blue line it out or modify the contract such that it'll be enforceable. But, you know, application in California, oftentimes in the courts, is that if an aspect of it is not enforceable, then the whole thing is rendered void. And then you have no obligation. The other thing is there was like some recent law changes in our state in California, that is, that said if you had non-competition agreements in previously existing contracts and you didn't advise your associate that to the extent that language existed, it was void, that also could operate to ban your contract or void out your contract. So there are laws like that you need to be aware of. And so that's one aspect of it. The other aspect as it relates to hiring somebody that maybe has dental specific knowledge would be maybe an understanding of how the courts have addressed professional service providers in your particular state. Also, the way the compensation formulas are defined and whether they make sense in the construct of operating a dental practice.
Well, at the end of the day, if there is a dispute between senior doctor and associate doctor, there are some very, very smart attorneys like yourself who are going to get involved, and it's going to get ugly. So we don't want to get into any of those stories right now, but just be aware, doctors, you know, don't go to ChatGPT. And nothing against ChatGPT, it's amazing, but don't go to ChatGPT to create your associate agreement. Go to a dental specific attorney in your state, and potentially, they will, if you need see the needs to go consult with an employment law attorney. Sean, take a second and tell me a little bit about your law practice. And I want you to give out your phone number and your email. Folks, again, if you have anything coming up legal, buying a practice, selling a practice, negotiating a lease, associate agreements, partnerships, you're not a litigator, right, Sean?
Not anymore.
But
when I first came out of law school, I had the designs on becoming, you know, a great trial attorney. And I had litigated for my first decade of practice, business disputes, insurance defense matters. Over time, I did not like the idea of perpetuating people's problems. I didn't get a lot of job satisfaction out of it. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, I get a lot more satisfaction about over solving people's problems or helping them achieve a milestone in their life. And so, about the time I started having kids, got married, I pivoted the focus of what I do. And so I no longer litigate. But the nice thing about it is I did have that background in terms of like, having an understanding about what people would get into disputes over, the way language was worded, and having some understanding of how things are litigated has helped inform the work I do in terms of thinking like, what is ambiguity here that we need to solve for, or what could go wrong in this particular contract?
Yeah. So talk about what you do in your practice, and then I want you to give out your, whatever information, how people can get a hold of you.
Sure. So, the practice is focused on the representation of dentists and their needs, kind of a general counsel for dentists, if you will. Entity formations, a lot of commercial leasing negotiations, associateship agreements, of course, but partnership agreements, also, you know, a big bread and butter of what I do is practice transitions and purchase agreements, as well as real estate purchase agreements. I focus on representing my clients throughout the state of California. The interesting thing about the work I do is that I work very intensely with a client for a few months, and then the deal is done and we've reached their goal. At that point, it's off to another client. And a lot of times, unfortunately, I don't get to meet my clients in person face to face because they're everywhere. But sometimes at a convention or if I'm speaking, somebody will come up and say, "Hey, you helped me a couple of years ago," and introduce themselves. And that's always nice to meet people. In terms of contacting me, my practice, as I mentioned, is in Orange County. But, you know, like I said, the clients are everywhere in the state of California. The easiest way might be just to go through my website, which is my initials, J as in Joseph, S as in Sean, D as in dumb, JSD, lawoffice.com. So that's simple. And then, of course, you can, you know, click there to be, you know, to get in touch with my email. My phone numbers are there as well. My office phone number is 888-212-3866. And that's a toll-free 888-212-3866. And then also you can always email me at info@jsdlawoffice.com as well. So happy to answer any questions that people might have that come up as a result of listening to our podcast today.
Appreciate that. All right, let's jump into my favorite subject, as you know, office leases. Now, okay. I'm going to set the table for you because this could be like 3 hours, but we have about maybe 15-20 minutes to talk about this. Okay, sure. So a dentist is going to go and look for a space. Either they're going to look for a space or they're going to buy a practice and they're going to be stuck with the landlord in that space. So I know that there are companies out there, we're not going to name names, who will go in and negotiate or find a doctor starting up a practice, a space, all right? And then there's Sean Dumb, the attorney. Talk about what a lease negotiator is going to do and what they're not going to do. And again, we're not getting specific with any names. And then, Sean, talk about what you as an attorney do. Like, you're not going to negotiate generally the rate of rent or tenant improvement allowance. That's what a negotiator does. So in your world, talk about what a dentist needs between a dental attorney and maybe someone to go in and find them or negotiate a space.
Certainly. So there are matters where a client will come to me and they've got a term sheet from the landlord and ask me to negotiate directly on those term sheets. But one of the problems I have is that I don't have a sense of what the market rents are everywhere, right? So it's impossible for me to say, in your city, I think that $3 a square foot is a fair market rent, you know, because I haven't run those rental analysis. So as a result, there are real estate brokers that focus on healthcare that are out there that are very competent that will, one, do that rental analysis and a market rate analysis, but also negotiate. And oftentimes, I think that they are most valuable in matters where it's open shell. And we're looking to do a complete build out of space. And so typically you're looking for the landlord to come to the table with some significant tenant improvement allowance and how that'll be applied. That can be very beneficial. And then the negotiator will, you know, go back and forth with the landlord in an effort to create a term sheet that is the framework for the lease. I like to be involved before that's signed, of course, because I'll have input from a legal standpoint. But it is nice to start a review before that is signed. And then thereafter, my job is to, you know, be looking at that as a framework and comparing it with the ultimate contract that we'll be presented with.
Okay, so there's a differentiation. So if you hire somebody from one of these, and most of them are excellent at what they do, lease negotiation companies or finding you a space, you absolutely need to hire someone like Sean, because those folks are generally, as I understand it, not attorneys at law. And the legal documents that are leases are huge. Now, with that said, Sean, let's talk about landlords in general. Now, I am not going to mention any names, but I am going to say, and I have said on this podcast before, and I'm still not in jail, as a group, and I apologize to any of you doctors who own your own space or buildings, and you are landlords. Landlords are, in general, evil human beings. They are out for one thing and one thing only, and that is to extract as much money out of you, the tenant, as they possibly can. Whether you agree with that, Sean, or not, we'll hear in a moment. But talk about what a doctor needs to do. I mean, a dentist going in there to negotiate his or her own lease, that's kind of dangerous to me. So how should they be working? They found their own spot, or someone found them a spot. So, when do you get involved and what do you do?
Yeah. So a lot of times I get brought into the matter after that letter of intent term sheet has already been signed and the client has already committed themselves to certain key terms, which can be unfortunate because then the landlord may be very inflexible in modifying what those terms would be. So in an ideal world, it'd be nice to be brought in a little bit earlier, so I can review. And if important issues exist that did not get integrated into that term sheet, try to raise them or point them out, particularly if there's something I think is maybe ambiguous or needs to be better worded or defined. But then thereafter, once that's done, ultimately you might have a 3 or 4 page term sheet that you might receive a 50 page lease. So right. The obligation is to look at all the extra that's in there and see what's in there. And my goal generally is to treat that very similar to the way the doctor would treat informed consent to their patient, right? So a patient comes and they sit in your chair and they want to have a particular procedure done, or you're presenting them with their options. I want to let them know what's the risks, what's the benefits of the lease. And I want to let them know, here are the things that may cause untimely termination rights or surprise charges, or may result in chaotic issues in the event you want to sell your practice and assign your lease later on down the road, and inform my client as to those issues. And then, of course, ultimately, it's kind of a risk tolerance with landlords. You mentioned previously, as a group, they tend to be very aggressive. They are the chaos agents in any dental practice transition. And in that, you never quite know where a transaction is going to go with the leasing situation. And oftentimes, your intended closing date can be very much thwarted by the landlord. That's my focus. Let the client know what's in there, and then address what it is that either I recommend or whatever they don't have a risk tolerance for. If they're comfortable with certain aspects of the lease, then that's fine, because ultimately we kind of have to focus on what our biggest issues are when you have a 70-page shopping center lease. We can't rewrite the whole thing. We're never going to get anywhere with a publicly traded real estate company. We need to focus on what's most essential.
Yeah. So you and I were involved in a deal that just closed about a month ago, or a month and a half ago.
Yes, we were.
And this is our poster child. All we're going to say is that it is in California. We're not going to tell you where it is. Mm-hmm. And when we started this journey and I took the listing as a broker, the seller said to me, "Oh, Art, don't worry about the landlord. I used to coach his kids in soccer and in Little League." Yeah. So, Sean, why don't you tell our listeners how that helped him in getting his practice sold?
Well, I mean, certainly that situation, as well as other situations, you know, the landlord's a patient of mine, the landlord and I go to church together, or whatever, you know, whatever those types of situations, I always bristle and say, well, okay, you know, well, let's see. In this particular instance, it certainly didn't matter. And the professional courtesies that were sought to, like, hey, we're looking to close by this date, none of that mattered, because ultimately it was going to be on their timeline, on their terms. And all of the professional relationships even personal relationships were inconsequential to the transaction itself. Because ultimately, a landlord's got a landlord.
Yeah. So what happened is about 2 weeks before closing, we got down to the final conversation with the landlord, and they informed us that they were not going to let the buyer assume the lease. And we said, well, wait a minute, it's assumable. And he said, well, if you want to wait 2 years in litigation, sure, be my guest. And by the way, we want a new lease, and we are raising the rent by $4,000 a month, which was about a 35% increase. Well, that kind of blew the deal up, so we had to go back to the drawing board. This is what you need to understand, doctors, if you're going to sell your practice. So let's talk real quick about if a doctor is going to go get ready with their within 5 years. Shouldn't they come to you now and say, look at my lease, let's see if there's anything that we can negotiate with the landlord, maybe an extension, maybe something, you know, isn't that a good idea, Sean?
Well, certainly, it's an excellent time to, if you're up for a lease renewal, or you're about to exercise an option, that's an excellent time for you to have your lease reviewed by somebody to evaluate it, not just for this upcoming option term, but also with an eye towards a future transition and retirement. We need to maybe pay a little closer attention than we have all these years as to what does the assignment language look like? What rights do we have? What limitations do we have? What power does the landlord have over us? Does the landlord have the power to just terminate the lease and negotiate fresh with the buyer? Or does the landlord have to exercise reasonable discretion in granting the assignment? Or do they have, they can do whatever they want at their sole discretion? Those little terms, where you have to kind of look at those closely to find out how much control the landlord's going to have over the transaction.
So talk about for a second, we have a doctor who has come down to the last year of either their final lease term or their final option term. Mm-hmm. And now either they get into a health issue or they want to retire. Talk about the danger that we have, Sean, in only having a few months or 6 months or a year left on the lease and the leverage that gives the landlord.
Well, certainly, there will be very little control that you have over the landlord's choice of action. So if you only have a few months left, the landlord could assign the lease, certainly, but they may assign and refuse to extend. And so they'd say, okay, we're legally obligated to assign. We'll assign the next 3 months on the lease. And then after that, we're not going to renew. No buyer is going to get funding from a lender for that, because the lenders typically will require a length of control. My experience has been that most practice notes tend to be about 10 years. A lot of lenders like to see 10 years plus of lease plus lease options of control for the buyer side. Some lenders out there will fund a 10-year practice note with 5 years of lease and lease options, but 3 months isn't going to get it done, right? There's too much uncertainty. They don't want you looking for other space and paying for a build out of some other space while you're paying your practice note. So as a result, the landlord could say, we want to do a new lease. However, we want, you know, whatever new exorbitant rate or ransom that they should desire. And then the flip side of it is the landlord could say, we'll assign the lease, but we're going to assign and extend, and the extension rents are going to be much higher. And they might use that as a device to keep the seller liable, not just for the next 3 months that they had under their lease term, but for the next 5 to 10 years potentially. So you could be sitting in retirement for many, many years only to find out that your buyer defaulted years after the closing and get a notice letter that they're already $75,000 behind in rents and you're still financially obligated under this lease.
Yeah. And the other thing that's really important, doctors, and I would hope, Sean, you would agree with me, you need to put on multiple calendars and sticky notes and on your refrigerator what the exact date is that you must exercise an option. Mm-hmm. I am an expert witness right now in a case where it was a non-dental real estate broker did not exercise an option for a dentist. Mm-hmm. And that dentist was, they missed the date. And then they were forced to go and spend a stupid amount of money building out a new office. And there was no medical dental space within 5 miles. And they lost a lot of patients. And I'm hired as the expert witness to calculate the damages. So that's important too, isn't it?
It is. And I can even tell you from my personal engagement agreements, I make it very clear that I will not be calendaring those dates because of that exact paranoia that something is going to happen. It is one of these things that if you're a tenant holding options and you have an option to renew, oftentimes in these leases, the landlords will give you a tight window for exercise. And that window may be a 3-month window, but the window is 12 months prior to the termination of the lease, but no later than 9 months, you know? So you have to exercise this option 9 months before the end of your lease term. Last month, I saw one that was 18 to 15 months before the end of the lease term. You're not even thinking about renewing your lease right at that point. That comes and go really easy. So a lot of times, you know, perhaps your landlord would be willing to extend the lease. And maybe if you had an option that said that option rents were going to extend at a certain lockstep, they might still extend you, but they might disregard those more favorable rent terms and seeking a market rate correction. But you can run into those circumstances where the landlord may desire to redevelop the space, or they may want your space because maybe there's maybe you're in a medical building and there's a very large practice group, a surgery group that wants the whole floor for a surgery center or something like that. And you're an impediment to that. And so they're more than happy to have you miss that date so they don't have to spend money relocating you or they can proceed with higher revenue earning opportunities.
We're getting down to the end of our time, Sean, but we could spend hours and hours. The bottom line is, doctors, if you are anywhere near 5 years from retirement, or even if you're not, I just think you should give someone like Sean a call. And again, I get nothing from referring business to the people that I trust, which is who comes on this podcast. And you just need to make sure that you know what your rights are, what your rights are not, and that you are prepared. Let's touch on, and then we'll put a bow on this, dental partnerships. What are some of the landmines that you see when, you know, we've got senior doctor, hires associate, they're working a year or two or three, mm-hmm. and then they want to get married, if you will, from a business sense. Mm-hmm. What do you see as some of the mistakes that are made and the pitfalls and what people should be looking at?
Yeah. So in the scenario you describe, which is like an associate to partnership scenario, one of the things that always concerns me is that there's a disparity of bargaining power. The owner of the practice is very intimately familiar with all aspects of the practice and how it's being run. And the associate may have worked there for a while, but they don't necessarily have full access to the finances of the practice or certain knowledge about the way things are run. So I consider there to be a conflict of interest. Even if there was somebody coming in with a 50% ownership, there's still that disparity of owner bargaining power because you've got one person that's been there for such a long period of time that has all this knowledge that the other person could possibly hope to acquire. So in those types of situations, I recommend separate legal counsel for certain. Some people might represent both sides, but I always feel uncomfortable with that. But then in the actual partnership, first of all, a handshake will only get you so far, right? Ultimately, there are aspects of being in partnership with somebody that are very different than working for somebody. And they come down to, Is there a managing partner? Is there a person that's like, you know, essentially driving the ship? And is there somebody along for the ride? If the managing partner is in charge, what decision power do they have? What limitations upon their authority exist? How are we going to pay ourselves? And also those issues of subsequent transition, if it doesn't work out, or if somebody wants to retire, or if somebody has a disability, or if somebody dies, or if somebody loses their license, and how do you deal with all those situations as well? What expenses of the partnership are personal versus expenses of the practice?
Yeah, that's
one you see a lot of, you know, like looking for people's finances, and you know, somebody hasn't paid for paper towels personally for however many years, because it's just the Costco charge and computers and cell phones and everything's being run through practices, and you can certainly address that easily. But how do you deal with that when those credit card purchases are for family member items, but you have a partnership? You know, is that a distribution? And does the other person get a offsetting distribution? All those kind of things.
Yeah.
That's huge. It's the partnership agreement is kind of a prenup, and the goal is to address as many things as we possibly can. And ultimately, you know, it doesn't feel good if, you know, a partnership breaks up and, you know, your contract is being scrutinized because of whatever language is in there. So you try to make it as fair as you can for the parties. And again, I it's for that reason, I don't want to represent all the parties. Unless they're coming in at like some initial startup situation where they're all on equal footing.
Yeah. I mean, partnerships are a whole nother podcast that we'll have to do another one of someday. Last question, loaded question. What's the difference between someone who's just a general contract attorney and a dental specific attorney? I mean, I'm going to let you do a little commercial for yourself. Why is it important to work with dental specialists?
I guess it's repetition, right? It's very similar to, you know, my wife being an endodontist is like, why would you send a patient to an endodontist to do a root canal versus, a general dentist? And again, it's the experience level, it's the familiarity, it's the repetitions that you have. So it's the speed in which you can get to answers or solutions because of the knowledge you have that's specific to the field of dentistry or the business of dentistry. And also, just kind of having a sense of what is industry custom or what is normal in a contract versus what is being sought that is wildly atypical or not necessarily fair in a contract. And so having this background and experience allows me to, I think, be a better advocate for my client than I would be if I was suddenly asked to come into a purchase agreement for some field like a restaurant franchise or something that I lack that kind of knowledge for, right? So I'm not going to be as effective. I'm going to spend more time getting up to speed. I'm going to bill my clients more money learning about what restaurant franchises are like and all of the pitfalls there. So having that background and knowledge, I think it tends to be cost-effective and a little bit more effective from a time standpoint as well.
Sean Dumm, you are a wealth of knowledge. You've given our listeners a lot to think about. Doctors, if you have an office lease, just send it to Sean. Let him take a look at it. He'll tell you where the landmines are. If you're doing a partnership, he'll tell you where all the things you got to be thinking about, associate agreements. And we didn't even have time to get into purchase and sale agreements on the purchase or sale of a dental practice. One more time, Sean, how does someone get a hold of you if they have a question?
Sure. Oh, I always love to be a resource for people. I think probably the most efficient way is just to kind of go to my website, which is jsdlawoffice.com. Just my initials, J. Sean Dumm, lawoffice.com. And if you go there, there's links to contact me. All my contact information's on there as well. That's probably the most efficient way. And if you send a little inquiry on there, then an email will get routed to me.
Sounds good, Sean. If you will hang with me while I take the podcast out, I want to thank you for your great information and expertise that you've shared with our thousands of listeners. And, guys, I have been an expert witness in a courtroom. I have testified. And I'll tell you what, litigators are tough people. And, you know, that's why you want to have your documents tied up as best as you possibly can. So again, thanks a lot, Sean. And again, please hang with me as I take the podcast out. Folks, please make sure that you go to our website of our wonderful marketing partner, Decisions in Dentistry Magazine, www.decisionsindentistry.com. 140 continuing education courses at a very, very reasonable price. Go to www.decisionsindentistry.com. Give us a call at iBailey if you are not getting the really good dental CPA specific service that you are really looking for. My email is awiederman, A-W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N at iBailey, E-I-D-E-B-A-I-L-L-Y.com. Or call me at 657-279-3243. If you're in Chicago for the Midwinter Conference, come by my lectures. I believe I'm lecturing on Friday. I have to look at the schedule. I should probably know that. And then also, if you're in Las Vegas in June, and I'll keep you posted at the AGD meeting at Caesar's Palace in June. And again, please tell your friends about the podcast. Please subscribe if you're not subscribers on your favorite Apple or Spotify. And again, I want to thank everyone. I want to thank Sean for his great information today. And as we go into 2026, we have a lot of really new and exciting stuff coming up. So please keep listening. We're going to keep doing what we can to keep you out of trouble, give you great information about how to manage your practice, the financial, the legal aspects, all this kind of stuff. And with that said, my name is Art Wiederman, CPA. I'm a dental division director with the CPA firm of Ide Bailey. And I thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. The Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast is produced by Ide Bailey in partnership with Art Wiederman, CPA, Decisions in Dentistry Magazine, and the Academy of Dental CPAs. For audience questions and feedback, email Art Wiederman, awiederman at idebailey.com. That's A-W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N at E-I-D-E-B-A-I-L-L-Y.com. Or you may call Art at 657-279-3243.